Those in particular who were eyewitnesses of the battle line of the World War will not yet have forgotten scenes and circumstances which must make the work of the Imperial War Graves Commission even more remarkable, to their judgment that it can only be to the majority who were spared the sinister realities of the modern Golgotha. In the clash and bewilderment of actual fighting, in the rapid ruin and chaos and oblivion of the front line, with its enormous process of annihilation, perhaps not many soldiers retain the confidence that the dead, themselves it might be, tomorrow or the next instant, would at length obtain some lasting and distinct memorial. These words were written in 1937 by Edmund Blunden, who'd won the Military Cross during the Great War and was himself a famous poet and writer, most notably famous for his masterpiece Undertones of War. So welcome to another episode of a podcast that I've been calling Tales from the Battlefield. For those who don't know me, my name's Terry Wenham. And this is the first of probably several podcasts when we'll talk about the work of what was called the Imperial War Graves Commission, but is now known to everybody as the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. In this episode, you'll hear an interview that I carried out last week when the weather was much nicer than it is today with Megan Kelleher, who's one of the public engagement coordinators for the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. And we had an interesting chat about lots of things, really. So that will be coming up in a few minutes. But what I wanted to do, first of all, was just give some background about this wonderful institution that we call the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. So cometh the hour, cometh the man. Who was that man? That man was Major General Sir Fabian Ware, who was born in 1869 and died in 1949. Fabian Ware, at 45 years old in 1914, was too old to fight in the Great War. So on the 19th of September 1914, just over a month after the beginning of the war, Fabian Ware went off to Boulogne to assume responsibility for the motor vehicles and personnel of the Red Cross mission in the Lille and Amiens district. He installed himself in a hotel in Lille, and he took over the miscellaneous collection of cars and volunteer drivers that at that stage made up the Red Cross Mobile Unit, or the Flying Unit as they called it. In addition to establishing a field hospital to treat the wounded, Fair told his men to collect information of where the dead had been buried and to take precise notes on the location of every cemetery that they came across. And this was the start of it, really. It wasn't until May 1917 that the Imperial War Graves Commission came into being because of a royal charter. But Ware believed that every soldier who died serving his country should be commemorated at the public expense, because this had never been done before. We'd never really had a citizen army before. So the immense task of satisfying a growing sentiment among the people of the British Empire by caring for the unprecedented number of graves was quite unforeseen. It had never been done before, and it was left to this one man to contrive the machinery and a plan that would make a reality of this new concept. Right from the outset, Ware emphasised the importance of the Imperial or the Commonwealth contribution to the war effort. He was encouraged by the then Prince of Wales, and in May 1917, as I said, the Imperial War Graves Commission was established by the Royal Charter. The Prince of Wales became the President and Ware was the Vice Chairman. But of course, it wasn't until the end of the war that the Commission's work could really begin. And what a work they'd got. It was Rudyard Kipling, he described it as the biggest work since the Pharaohs. And of course, as we know, the Pharaohs' work was all in their own country. The work of the Commission was going to be throughout the world. By 1918, at the armistice, some 587,000 graves had been identified. But what we knew from the records was there was another 559,000 dead that were registered as having no known grave. This was going to be an immense effort to record and commemorate all these missing men. In 1918, Ware invited Sir Frederick Kenyon, who was the director of the British Museum, to carry out a report, which was called, as you'd expect, the Kenyon Report, when it was published in 1918. Now, Kenyon visited the battlefields, and from his report, this is what he found. Many bodies are found, but cannot be identified. Many are never found at all. Many are buried in graves which have subsequently been destroyed in the course of the fighting. This is especially the case in areas such as that of Ypres, where the same ground has been contested for three consecutive years and the whole countryside has been blasted and torn with shellfire. Therefore, whatever may be done in the way of placing individual monuments over the dead, in many cases no such monument is possible. Yet these must not be neglected, and some memorial there must be to the lost, the unknown, but not the forgotten dead. And then he summarised his findings with his vision for the cemeteries, and Kenyon went on, "The general appearance of a British cemetery will be that of an enclosure with plots of grass or flowers or both, separated by paths of varying size and set with orderly rows of headstones, uniform in height and width. Shrubs and trees will be arranged in various places, sometimes as clumps at the junction of ways, sometimes as avenues along the sides of the principal paths, sometimes around the borders of the cemetery. The graves will, wherever possible, face towards the east, and at the eastern end of the cemetery there will be a great altar stone and bearing some brief and appropriate phrase or text. Either over the stone or elsewhere in the cemetery will be a small building where visitors may gather for shelter or for worship, and where the register of the graves will be kept. At some prominent spot will rise the cross as a symbol of the Christian faith and of the self-sacrifice of the men who now lie beneath its shadow." And it was from that report that the three main principles of the commission which are followed today were agreed. Number one, each of the dead should be commemorated by the name on a headstone or a memorial. Number two, that these headstones and memorials should be permanent. And number three, headstones should be uniform and no distinction made on account of military or civil rank. So the decision was also made much earlier in the war in 1915 that none of these bodies would be repatriated, a very controversial decision. In the first year or so of the war, wealthy and privileged families did actually repatriate their dead back to the UK. But for the majority of people, that would be impossible. And there was no way that the government could fund such an immense task. And that's why the decision was made to create these beautiful cemeteries and memorials that we now see on the Western Front and beyond. This was a very, very controversial subject. And for several years, the Commission and the government received criticism from those that wanted to bring their loved ones back. And of course, for those parents, it was a bitter reality that they would never be able to have a name inscribed on a headstone in their local cemetery, their son, brother, father, beneath that grave. It just wasn't going to be possible. And eventually, the decision went to the House of Commons. There was a very heated debate on what was going to happen, but it was Winston Churchill, who was then the Secretary of State for War and Air, that closed the debate with these words. And this is what he said: "The cemeteries will be entirely different from the ordinary cemeteries which mark the resting place of those who pass out in the common flow of human fate from year to year. They will be supported and sustained by the wealth of this great nation and empire." And there is no reason at all why the graveyards in France of this great war shall not remain an abiding and supreme memorial to the efforts and glory of the British Army and the sacrifices made in the great cause. So what do we have now, over 100 years later? We have 1.7 million men and women commemorated throughout the world in 23,000 locations by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. There are 1.1 million headstones, which means that there's 600,000 men and women that are remembered on the memorials to the missing in places like Teepvale, Singapore, the Menin Gate and beyond. In Belgium, at a place called Pau Capelle, there's the grave of 14-year-old John Condom of the Royal Irish Rifles. He was killed in May 1915 in a gas attack, one of the gas attacks by the Germans during the Second Battle of Ypres. And he was originally buried in a mass grave with other casualties. But in 1923, when the Commission and the British Army were clearing the battlefields, they found his body. And at first they thought they wouldn't be able to identify him. But then on his boot, they discovered that his regimental number had been stamped. Therefore, giving this young 14-year-old lad an identity and his own grave at Poker Pell. Now, in recent times, there's been speculation, in fact, that he wasn't 14, that he was, in fact, 18. But there's no evidence for that, no actual documented evidence. And on the Commonwealth War Graves Commission records, he's still listed as being 14. 82 miles to the south on the Somme battlefield, you'll find the grave of Henry Webber. At the outbreak of war in August 1914, Webber was already well over 60 and he tried to join his three sons that were already in uniform. But he was repeatedly turned down. He was more than 20 years over the age limit. But eventually, on the 26th of July 1915, he was awarded a commission and he served with the 7th South Lancs Battalion, where apparently his younger officers did accept him. Perhaps they weren't aware of his true age, or when you look at photos, you can see he was a really old man. His commanding officer apparently found out that his own father and Webber had rode together at Oxford many years before, over half a century earlier. On the 17th of July 1916, during the Battle of the Somme, he wrote a letter back to his old school, and this is what he said in that letter. "Yet here I am, a lieutenant in the army, having to salute three sons if I meet them out here, a colonel and two majors. I'm first-line transport officer to this battalion, and we've been plumb in the centre of the picture during the last 10 days and gained no end of kudos and also a severe mauling. I'm so far extraordinarily fit and well, though, when I tell you that for 4 consecutive days I was either on my feet or in the saddle for 21 hours out of 24. You will see there is a bit of work attached to this job." But 4 days later, he was dead. On the 21st of July 1916, the 7th Lancs moved up to relieve a battalion in the front line near Mametz Wood. And that night, Webber took supplies as usual with the battalion transport, and he left his men to unload the horses. Why they were doing that, the story goes that Webber wandered over to talk to his commanding officer, who was talking to some other officers. And as they did so, they came under attack, and a shell landed nearby. Webber was one of 12 men and 3 horses that had been hit, and he suffered a head wound. He was taken to a dressing station, but he never regained consciousness, and he died that night, just a month after his 67th birthday. Back home, his widow, 2 years later, died, and according to the family, she was unable to recover from her husband's death. All 3 of his sons survived, and went on to serve actually in the Second World War. So there we have it. We've got John Condom at Poker Pell, killed in May 1915, one of the youngest on the Commonwealth War Graves Commission records, aged 14, to die in the Great War. And at the other extreme, the following year, 67-year-old Henry Webber, just 2 of the men amongst 1.7 million men and women that are commemorated by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. So that brings us neatly round to my interview with Megan last week, and I'll let her take up the story. So we're sitting at a National Trust property in Nottinghamshire called Southwell, and we're in the grounds of what was a workhouse. And I've come here to talk to Megan Kelleher from the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. And hopefully you can hear the skylark, the bird song in the background. That's not recorded, that's actually real. So first of all, Megan, have I pronounced your surname correctly?
Yes, Kelleher? Yeah, you have.
I have done that, good, done that right. So I've been working with the Commission now for 12 months as a volunteer in the Speakers Programme. And you are my Public Engagement Coordinator, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
PEC for short. So I wanted to talk to you about lots of different things, but firstly, tell us about yourself and how you came to work for the Commission.
Yeah, so offline we've been having such a wonderful conversation here with both Terry and his mother, who is sitting here listening to this podcast being recorded. And I got involved with the Commission sort of through a series of really fortunate events, actually. I was always interested in history when I was younger, but I became particularly interested initially growing up in southeast London with sort of the monarchs and things like that. And then as I got older, I became more interested in my dad's time in the Territorial Army in the 80s and 90s. We then became a bit more interested, as many people did, in their family history, particularly with the two world wars. And I found out that I have four relatives that were commemorated as a result of losing their lives in the First World War.
Wow.
So I went to the battlefields at 18 for the first time, and it was incredible because I got to see my great-great-grandfather's grave.
So was that a school trip or was that with your family?
It was a university trip. University. Yeah, first year university trip. And it was the first night that we were there. We went down this little country track to where my great-great-grandfather was. And I think I'm the first in my family to actually visit that.
Wow. And you were on your own just with the university, not with any other members of your family at the time?
No, just myself. So I sent those pictures to my family and sort of said, you know, this is Grandad Charles's grave.
Wow.
And that kind of inspired me to become really interested in the two world wars and even more so in that military history sort of thing. And then as I got older, I started specialising a bit more in that commemoration side of history. And I saw the Commonwealth War Graves Commission centenary intern, as it was then, come up. And I thought, I'll give that a go. It's something to do in the summer. I'd love to work overseas as well. And I got that.
Yeah.
And then while I was over there, I saw the job that I'm now in come up. And again, I thought, I'll apply for it and see what happens. And I was privileged enough to get that. So it's been that beautiful series of events. And in fact, my job now has inspired me with my PhD. Because I'm sure, as you found, Terry, you get asked so many unique and interesting questions when you're giving talks that I didn't know the answer to. And I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if someone could put all of this into a central location?
Yeah, it's been wonderful. What you've been working on. It is awful when you stood there and someone asks you, you think you've got all the answers covered in your head, and then someone comes out, always, every time someone comes out with something that you haven't thought of before. So just going back to your internship, I think you were at Tynecott, weren't you, during the centenary period then?
Yeah,
what was that like?
It was genuinely some of the best few months of my life. I've made such wonderful friends out there that I'm still really close to. We are now based all over Europe as a result of working with the commission through getting jobs and things like that in that particular area. So I spent 4 months out in Tynecott. We were living in Ypres itself.
Really?
And I could actually hear the bells of the cloth hall every 15 minutes. Yeah. So that was a good timer to work out whether I was running late.
Whether you were late for work or not.
which was really helpful. And I lived with five wonderful people. And we worked together. We became a very lovely family unit. And like I say, we're still
in touch
contact.
With them now.
Yeah. So one of them now lives in Belgium. Another one lives in the Netherlands. And we're all over the United Kingdom as well, doing some amazing jobs that some of my friends are doing. And that's all as a result of a lot of those questions in job interviews were asking about that internship.
Yeah.
So it just shows how impactful that is.
So when you were there then, and school parties or private parties turned up, a lot of people turn up with guides and they did their own thing. But presumably you were taking people around telling the stories of the soldiers in Tynecott.
Yeah, so that was our main job. We'd sort of go up to people and ask them if they were trying to find a relative, for example, but also talking to the school groups and working with those battlefield guides, learning from them some of their stories, but also telling them some of the stories that we'd learnt over the time on our internship.
Yeah.
And then also chatting to our operations staff that were there. So we had four full-time gardeners there.
Yeah.
At the time, three of them were Belgian. And then one of them we found out later on was Anglo-Belgian.
We only
found that out actually, anecdotally. One of my two of my friends are wonderful bakers, and we brought in some flapjacks to work to sort of greet the gardeners with. And the gardener that was Anglo-Belgian was talking about going on holiday to Stirling and seeing his dad's side of the family. And that was the day that we found out that he was half Scottish.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah. It was a really lovely experience.
And they enjoyed the flapjack as well.
Oh, they loved the flapjack, absolutely. And they, you know, if you haven't met any of the operations staff out there, they are so knowledgeable. They'll show you things that you might not have necessarily considered. You've walked past a particular grave each and every day. And it could be as simple as, you know, they've been working there for years. And they might say, I remember when that individual was found and that ceremony. And it's, you know, so beautiful to be part of that history.
And it is, you know, it's like someone was saying, Paul Reed was saying on one of these podcasts recently, I think he said he's been there more than 1,000 times, but every time he goes, he finds a new story. Because there's 12,000 stories plus the 35,000 on the wall, isn't there, waiting to be told?
Definitely. And it's, you know, you think you might have a full story and then you find a relative looking for them. Yeah. And they'll tell you a bit of anecdotal information that you might not be able to find on Ancestry. One thing that we found on my first day, I met a lady who was talking about her grandfather, I believe it was, who was on the memorial. And he was a Hackney cab driver. And things like that. And it was just so lovely to hear it from those relatives.
It brings them to life, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it was poignant for them to finally see the name or to see the grave. But it was also really poignant for me to be part of that family experience of finally seeing that and learning more about them. And then you can tell the public about it as well.
And that's what's inspired you then to go on and become a fully employed employee with a commission then, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Oh, excellent. So... You've got a piece of paper here with some stories on. Do you want to talk us through some of those personal stories that are close to you then?
Yeah, so the first story I wanted to talk about is an air cadet casualty that's not too far from here. So my background is that when I was younger, I joined the air cadets or the air training corps specifically. And that's what I did for most of my teenage years, my early 20s. Oh, right. So the air cadets are a special story for me, and I was really privileged to find that one of them is commemorated at Newark-upon-Trent Cemetery.
Oh, right.
Which, of course, is only about 20 minutes from here.
Yeah, just down the road, yeah.
And his name's Cadet Keith Rowlison Cousin Wood. Yeah. And I find it really interesting because his parents are listed as being from Leigh-on-Sea in Essex. But on the morning of the 29th of July 1942, Keith and a fellow air cadet called Geoffrey Hughes were taken up on an air experience flight. And they were taken up in a Hanley Page Hamden bomber from 408 Squadron. And it was, for Keith, his first air experience flight, which if anyone is an air cadet or has had that experience, it's always really daunting to be put in an aircraft for the first time.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the aircraft stalled and crashed into a field of oats 2 miles southeast of the airfield where they were at RAF Balderton. So they were doing an air test from there for a raid that later on that night. But the aircraft caught fire on impact and was destroyed in that accident. And Keith and Geoffrey sadly died in the incident alongside squadron leader Lyle Basil Berman Price, who was a Distinguished Flying Cross recipient, and Sergeant Idris Hughes. And both Keith and Geoffrey are just 16, so among those younger age casualties.
16. And they were up in an aircraft, age 16, in the middle of the Second World War.
Absolutely. On an air experience flight. Which, you know, is a really exciting experience, and it's awful that that's how it ended.
I'll just think back to when I was 16, and, you know, I wasn't safe on a push bike, let alone going up in an aeroplane, and you just realise that what that generation were like, you know, so different to today's, or even my time as a teenager. And they're in Newark.
Keith is, and then we've got Squadron Leader Price is at Brookwood Military Cemetery in Surrey.
Okay, Surrey, yeah.
Sergeant Hughes is buried at Moyla Drefan Herman Congregational Chapel Yard in Wales.
Right.
And then Cadet Hughes is at Whittington St Bartholomew Churchyard in Chesterfield.
So they've gone back to their families, have they?
Largely. But one of the things that I really love about Keith's grave, in spite of that awful circumstance of losing his life, is that his personal inscription, presumably chosen by his parents, was... Fearless gay, to God's arms he flew, his first venture in the boundless blue.
Oh, wow. That's really moving, isn't it? And I think that's something I've always found for the 25 years I've been wandering around Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries. I don't know about you, I always read the headstones from the bottom.
Yes.
With a family inscription and then work my way up, because so many of them are just like that. They do go straight for you. The strings in your heart, don't they?
Definitely. And I always say this, and I'm sure you do the same, Terry, when you're giving talks, you know, it can be so overwhelming to see many headstones. So by looking at that personal inscription at the bottom, you really get to see how the family were feeling,
who they were,
and a bit more information. And I find they are more impactful when you are showing visitors around.
Definitely.
Which is, really beautiful.
Wow. Have you got any others there to tell us about?
Yeah, so the other one, again, this might be familiar to some of your listeners, because I'm sure that they followed this story when it happened back in sort of 2018. And that's Captain Henry John, sometimes known as Jack Innes Walker. Now, he's not a relative of mine. I know I sort of have mentioned him to you offline.
Yeah.
But I find him really interesting, and I'll explain why towards the end. But he was born in Auckland in New Zealand in 1890. And he gained his commission into the New Zealand Defence Force before getting a commission into the Royal Warwickshire Regiment from Sandhurst in 1911.
Right.
He was a keen athlete and rugby player, playing for Blackheath Rugby Club, which, again, for listeners, Terry and I have been bonding over the fact that we grew up in sort of the South East London, Kent borders. Yeah. So that would have been one of the local rugby clubs
us. It's still a well-known rugby club, I think, now, Blackheath.
Yeah,
isn't it?
And it's a really interesting rugby club. I know my sister and dad used to go there on Saturdays, so, you know,
I've got a feeling that one of our fellow historians and guides plays for Blackheath Veterans.
Yes, I'm pretty sure he does.
Andy Locke.
Yes. Shout out to Andy.
Yes. Hello, Andy.
But yeah, and sadly, Captain Walker was killed in action on the 25th of April 1915 in Ypres.
Right.
And according to research on the Imperial War Museum website, they were talking about he was shot in the stomach at about 3:30 in the morning as his company advanced to take a defended wooded area.
Yeah.
And his body at the time was last seen lying in a large shell crater, which was about 45 metres from a German trench.
Yeah.
And they believed that the enemy would have probably buried him in the natural grave of that shell crater. But after the First World War, he had no known graves. He was one of the New Zealanders that served with other elements of the British Empire forces that are commemorated on the Ypres Menin Gate Memorial.
Right.
But then in 2015, some archaeologists working on a dig in a Flanders field uncovered 45 fallen soldiers, and of which he was one of those.
Wow.
And they used objects found on his body, which included a pair of binoculars, a whistle and a medallion.
Wow.
Along with that bone material analysis and the examination of historical sources. And they concluded that it could only be Captain Walker.
Could only have been him. He was the only captain in that area with that regiment on that date.
Yeah.
Which presumably is near Kitchener's Wood.
I would presume so, yeah.
Wow.
And so he was reburied along six of his unknown Royal Warwickshire colleagues in April 2018 at New Irish Farm Cemetery.
Ah, right.
And there's a number of different reasons why that's fascinating to me. So around that same time of April 2018, that was when I officially moved to Belgium to start my own internship. But it's also interesting because in spite of my South East London accent, my great-grandma is from Birmingham and her dad served with the Royal Warwickshire Regiment.
There's the connection.
Yeah, and so the chap that I saw that first night when I went to the battlefield trip at 18, his name is Private Charles Bonnard. He's buried at the Pludoux Farm Cemetery, which is along the Plug Street area.
Yeah.
And he served with the Royal Warwickshires and is the same age as Captain Walker. And my great-great-grandfather, his story is particularly sad because when he died, my great-great-grandmother was 7 months pregnant with their only child.
7 months?
Mm-hmm. Which is my my great-grandmother.
Yeah.
And in addition to that sad story, my great-great-grandmother sadly passed away a couple of years later.
Really?
So my great-grandmother was raised by aunts and things.
Orphaned, yeah.
But my great-grandmother's middle name was Innes.
Yeah.
And we always asked her, and I'm not going to attempt to do a Brummie accent or anything. but when we used to say to her, you know, that's quite an unusual name. Where did that come from? She used to say, you know, you're named after your dad's commanding officer.
Right.
And that was the end of that conversation.
Yep.
And I did some very basic research and I found out that they say serve with the same battalion of the same regiment.
Oh, wow.
And they're killed within about a month of each other in this area of Ypres. And so in all likelihood, Captain Walker, is my, potentially my great grandmother's, is the namesake of him.
Yeah.
And I thought it was particularly poignant that he finally got a known grave around the same time that a descendant of that particular individual was coming to Belgium. Yeah.
This has been said so many times by so many people. There's no such thing as a coincidence when it comes to the West. You feel as though, and I'm sure you've had this feeling, I've had experiences like that at Tyne Court where someone's asked me to research someone and they're there. It feels as though the soldiers are pulling you in. They're calling you back, aren't they? I know that's absolutely impossible scientifically, but that's how it feels, isn't it, from inside inside your heart.
Yeah, and it feels, I don't know if you find this, Terry, but sometimes I sometimes refer to them as, you know, my boys or my girls, depending on who I'm researching. You know, I've got no personal connection to them.
No.
But they become almost a part of you.
That's right.
And it becomes a really important project to then research them. You know, I've got individuals in my PhD research that I'm sure my family want me to stop going on about at the dinner table, the latest research that I found out about them. But I'm so excited to find out something more and then, you know, to connect it to an archival source and find out a bit more. You know, for example, there's a particular casualty who's the heir to Austin Motor Company, who's buried down in Canterbury. And when I was initially researching him, my supervisor at university actually put me onto that.
Yeah.
And for 2.5 years, I thought he had quite a quiet funeral service through Canterbury High Street.
Yeah.
And then I went to the British Motor Museum archives, and this has been corroborated by the King's School Canterbury archives. And I saw a picture of that funeral service.
Oh, really?
And I don't know how well you know Canterbury, but it's not a quiet service. They've got a gun carriage. There was part of it in the cathedral. They went down the high street on the back of a gun carriage with the local regiment providing that funerary march, coffin draped in a Union flag.
And you found all that just by going in the archives.
Yeah, and then it becomes that story where it's...
You feel as though you were there.
Thoughts.
You could have been there, couldn't you, in a different life?
Absolutely.
Perhaps you were.
Well...
That is incredible, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And he's buried, and you said, in New Irish Farm Cemetery, which is, for those who don't know, it's a rather large concentration cemetery. There's so many unknown in New Irish Farm, just outside of Ypres. So certainly when I go back in a few weeks' time, I shall be going to see his grave.
Definitely do.
And saying hello to him on your behalf.
Thank you. That's so kind. And I should also say that when I first went to visit New Irish Farm Cemetery, it was on a beautiful sort of midsummer sunset.
Mm.
And their graves are right near the front of the cemetery. And
really?
So it was almost like they were waiting to say hello.
Waiting for you. Yeah. That's amazing, isn't it? Huh. Wow. Have you got another one there?
No, I think that's everything.
Wow, that is something to think about, isn't it? So we've been talking more generally then about the commission. How can people get involved? I know we've got War Graves Week coming up, haven't we? And we're going to be doing some tours for the commission. And I think over 100 locations, is that right?
That sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah, so when is War Graves Week?
So it's the 20th to the 28th of May.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a wonderful event, building on the things that we did last year. So we're doing lots of tours and lots of events. So they'll be on our website very, very soon. So that can include coming along to tours and talks that people like Terry are doing and myself. We're actually hosting an event in Newark locally as well. In addition, if you have got a group, feel free to try and book a talk to learn more about the Commission's work. And again, we've got fantastic volunteers. I'm not just plugging Terry, all of my volunteers.
There's plenty of us, aren't there? Yeah. How many volunteers have we got now?
Gosh, that's a good question. In the East Midlands alone, we've got about 30.
Right.
And that's just for speakers, not the eyes on, hands on, and
got
other volunteering
on
objects.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the guiding that we just started to do now. And presumably people can book these. When they're announced, they can book them through the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website.
Yes, and all of these things are free. Yeah, Eventbrite, yeah.
And it's free of charge, isn't
it? Yes, yeah.
Turn up, and fingers crossed for good weather that week. If it's like this, it'll be amazing, won't it?
Definitely. It's so lovely to be out here.
Yeah, it is, yeah. The foundation, the Commonwealth War Graves Commission have got the foundation. How does that work? That inspires young people then?
Yeah, so they're our charitable branch, and that's where people can offer donations to and support the public engagement work and education work that the Commission does. So that could include, historically, that's been the internship programme. So I have a lot to thank the foundation for.
Yeah.
But also the speakers programme, eyes on, hands on, all of those sorts of things, helping to run those projects and support the education and outreach that come from those.
Right. And there's a couple of other things I've just been thinking about while we sat here. And we talked about during our talks, the Commonwealth War Commission archives. A lot of those are online, but has Maidenhead archives, actually physical archives, opened up now to the public?
They are open to the public. At the moment, they're in the middle of a refurbishment. So
right.
Do keep an eye on the website for when they do reopen. But they are a fantastic resource for any historian interested in the commission. So the records in terms of the cemetery records and casualty records are all available online for free to download. But if you are looking for something like a meeting minute that's not been digitised, which a large proportion of them have, I'd highly recommend visiting some of those.
I think what I've found digging around the archives is the photographic records on there. There's albums, isn't there, of people going on battlefield tours in the early 1920s and taking photographs of these cemeteries that we all know so well, but without the Portland headstones there, still with the original wooden crosses there. And motor cars sat outside, you know, people on tours and getting out of the motor cars, and it's an incredible archive, isn't it?
It really is, and I know among the archivists' favourite resources in that collection, and I use the term favourite in not quite the right way, is looking at the plans, the cemetery plans that our architects drew, and particularly the ones for the Italian cemeteries in the Second World War. They're in colour and they are beautiful and so evocative that you can sit there and look at them for hours if you have that time to do that.
Time, it's always time, isn't it? And are the commission still looking for volunteers in some parts of the country to do things?
Yes, they are. And again, this information is available on our website to have a look and see how you can get involved in the sort of different projects that you can be part of. So as Terry's mentioned, he's a speaker's volunteer. So that's going out and giving presentations. But if that's less your speed and you want to help with the Eyes on Hands On project, which is going around to local sites that are allocated to you to have a look at the war graves and make sure that everything's okay, working with the operations team to do that sort of work is really, really helpful. And of course, we've got our tour guide volunteers, as you've mentioned, they're sort of just starting to come out again this year, where they're conducting free tours across the country. Yeah.
We've had our training a couple of days ago.
Yes, Jane absolutely.
Did our training, so looking forward to doing that. And the Eyes on Hands On project, I do that in North Norfolk. A few cemeteries there. And the problem with that is you go around, I think I've got something like 50 graves that I'm responsible for checking on every few months. Of course, when you go to them, you look at these guys, you think, well, I've got to know more about him. So then you're back into the archives and you're researching and suddenly the day's gone.
it's definitely a rabbit hole to fall down.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, we've all been there as historians, haven't we? Well, that's fantastic. It's really enjoyable. Great to meet you at last.
Definitely.
After a year. So I've been working as a volunteer for the commission for a year and I've done, I don't know, about 15, 20 talks that you've given me to do, but this is the first time we've met in person because of COVID. So it's been great.
Definitely, and it's so lovely to be on out here on such a sunny day. You know?
It's incredible.
It's
really
beautiful.
Is. Yeah. So thank you very much, Megan.
Thank you.
So that interview with Megan Kelleher was recorded a couple of weeks ago now on a beautiful spring day. And of course, since then, we've had snow, ice, rain, wind. So we really did strike lucky on the day that we actually got to meet. So next week, I'm going to be out on the Somme for 3 days. And whilst I'm there, I'm going to be recording interviews with quite a few people that live and work on the Somme. So that should be that'll probably make up 2 or 3 different podcasts. We'll see how it goes when we're there. But that's all for this week. But I'd really like to thank Megan for her time and some of those incredible stories. Over the next few weeks, as more information is released, I'll give you more information about the War Graves Week, which, as Megan said, will be in the third week in May. But for now, I would like to dedicate this podcast to those 3 airmen that Megan talked about: Squadron Leader Price, Air Cadet Wood, who was just 16 years old, Sergeant Hughes, and Captain Walker, who is now buried in New Irish Farm Cemetery and his name removed from the Meningate Memorial.